content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Time Magazine. Today's program is supported by G. Suggs Insurance, a SureVest insurance group company. They can be reached at gsuggsinsurance.com, that is gsuggsinsurance.com. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from Time Magazine's edition dated August 17, 2026. The cover, as usual, is bordered in red with a narrow white inner border. Time is in large block capital lettering, superimposed upon a very light background. It's white against this off-white to beige background. It's hard to read. Time, but there it is. There's a collection of personages on this cover photo, including Marco Rubio, the Venezuelan prime minister or president, Debbie Rodriguez, and President Trump. In the background, there are ships, cities, an oil derrick, palm trees, airplanes, oil wells, and other people walking along. The caption reads, "The Venezuela Experiment." And I'm sorry, I said Debbie Rodriguez. The woman's name is Delcy Rodriguez, who is in charge of Venezuela. Beginning with The View, subtopic Nation, "We Can't Look Away" by Kika, or Keisha, K-I-C-A, Matos. Let's see if there's another author. Nope, but Matos is president of the National Immigration Law Center. That's M-A-T-O-S. After sustained outrage over the murders of Alex Preti and Renee Good in Minneapolis, forced a public reckoning with ICE, I hoped the worst was behind us. July showed me I was wrong. Two more deaths in 6 days. And this latest wave of violence is fueled by the tens of billions of dollars in new funding the agency received from a Congress that has failed to impose any restraints on ICE. And ICE is in capital letters because it's an acronym. July 7, an ICE officer shot and killed Lorenzo Salgado Arau through the window of his van in Houston. 6 days later, an officer shot Joan Sebastian Guerrero to death in his car. That might be Joan, J-O-A-N is the first name, on a quiet street in Biddeford, Maine. Two fathers killed in two consecutive weeks. In both instances, the agents were not wearing body cameras, and both times the government reached for a similar script, alleging the driver weaponized his vehicle. We are told to take that on faith. I do not. Neither should you, writes the author. Salgado Arau built homes in this country he called home for more than 30 years. He was raising three sons, one already an engineer, and one studying to become one. He was not even the person agents were looking for. None of the men in his van was. Those men, his brother and two co-workers, now may be the only surviving witnesses to what happened. According to representatives for their families, they have since been detained by ICE and have been pressured to sign paperwork that would allow their immediate deportation. The shooting took place in Magnolia Park, Houston's oldest Mexican-American neighborhood. Local advocates say ICE frequently conducts early morning operations in the neighborhood as people leave home for work. The targeted approach arguably reflects how ISIS tactics have shifted under the leadership of Department of Homeland Security Secretary Mark Wayne Mullen. Since he took on the role, violent encounters in immigrant neighborhoods have continued, but Americans often see and hear about them only when someone dies. Guerrero was 25 years old. He immigrated to the U.S. from Colombia in search of a better future for his family. According to a joint statement by the Maine Immigrants' Rights Coalition and Presente Maine, he had a work permit and a Social Security number. He worked two jobs to support his wife and daughter. He, too, was not the man ICE was hunting the day they shot him dead. A neighbor watched from his window as agents pulled Guerrero from his car, bleeding, and reported he told the agents, "I tried to stop." Those may be the last words Guerrero ever spoke. Another neighbor heard the gunfire and ran outside to find Guerrero's wife screaming on her knees beside their three-year-old daughter, still in her bluey pajamas. "I heard agony," the neighbor said. "I heard a howl that comes from your soul, that your whole life had just changed and it was never going to be the same." These killings are not isolated incidents. The New York Times reports at least 22 people have been shot at by ICE agents since President Trump returned to office. Five are dead, three of them U.S. citizens. In Minneapolis, agents were wearing body cameras, but federal prosecutors did not release the footage for months. The Fourth Amendment protects every person on U.S. soil, citizen or not, from unreasonable seizure and unjustified deadly force. It is clear to me ICE has threatened people's constitutional rights, treating them as optional. The agency appears to be accountable to no one but itself. Our collective power to hold ICE accountable starts with looking out for our neighbors and speaking out against injustice in our communities. But lasting change requires action from our elected officials. Outrage without a demand changes nothing, so here are ours. Every ICE officer in the field should wear a body camera, and footage of any shooting must be released within days. ICE officers should be prohibited from wearing masks. Every ICE shooting should be investigated by an independent body with real subpoena power answerable to Congress, not to DHS. And qualified immunity, the shield that lets federal agents kill and walk away, has to end. Juan Sebastian Guerrero's three-year-old daughter watched her father die in the street. Lorenzo Salgado Arau's brother sat beside him when he was shot. Two families needlessly lost the people they love to a rogue and violent agency. We owe them the truth. And to every family after them, to keep fighting to uphold the constitutional protections this government has so far refused to provide. Now, before another name, another van, another street stained with blood that did not have to be spilled. Written by Kika or Kisa, K-I-C-A, Matos, M-A-T-O-S. Next, the Risk Report by Ian Bremmer, contributing editor. It has been a summer of good news for Ukraine. Its drone strikes deep inside Russia have created gasoline shortages, strained Russia's economy, stoked anxiety among ordinary Russians, and created headaches for Vladimir Putin. Ukrainian forces have effectively isolated, occupied Crimea from the Russian mainland, and they continue to strike Russian vessels in the Black Sea and the Sea of Azov. But Russia has scored some points of its own recently, and not just by terrorizing Ukrainian civilians with long-range missiles. A newly intense campaign against Ukraine's Black Sea ports is exposing a shortage of air defense interceptors, disrupting grain exports, undermining export revenue, and halting arms deliveries to Ukrainian forces. Agricultural products account for 60% of the country's goods exports, and Russia's attacks come just as Ukraine's farmers prepare for the harvest season. If the disruption lasts, Russia could choke off a crucial source of foreign currency for Ukraine and boost Russia's international negotiating leverage by inflicting pain on major grain importers in Africa and Asia. Kiev is playing down the damage after a two-week Russian drone and missile barrage on Odessa and other coastal cities. Ukraine's agriculture minister claimed in July ports were open and operational. But roughly 90% of ship owners have suspended port calls because, as in the Strait of Hormuz near Iran, insurance premiums have soared as the risk of further attacks remains. This is not the first shutdown of Black Sea traffic since the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Waves of Russian attacks on ports in late 2025 and early 2026 did not slow operations for long. But this latest barrage is both broader and more intense, largely because Ukraine's recent successes, particularly inside Russia, have provoked Putin to try to reclaim battlefield momentum. For now, both Ukraine and Russia remain committed to aggressive military strategies. Ukraine's immediate problem is it relies on its limited supply of American-supplied Patriot interceptors, the only reliable defense against Russian missiles, to protect its cities and military supply lines. Shifting the Patriots to protect ports would be both expensive and dangerous. Knowing this, Russia will continue its port attacks with both missiles and swarms of drones, offering insurers no reason to lower premiums and ship owners no incentive to return. Beyond cutting into Ukraine's revenue and its ability to finance the war, Moscow also hopes to weaken international backing for Kiev by driving up global food prices. Ukraine supplies a quarter of Egypt's wheat imports and about 18% of Indonesia. It is also the EU's largest corn supplier, provides 92% of its sunflower oil imports, and remains an important source of feed grains and vegetable oils. Putin is betting that higher food prices, at a time when the American war with Iran is already driving up the cost of oil and much else, will persuade Ukraine's trade partners, particularly in Europe, to press Kiev to de-escalate its attacks inside Russia. That strategy is unlikely to work. European support for Ukraine remains strong, and governments suffering from higher prices are more likely to blame Moscow than Kiev. But Putin is now so anxious for battlefield wins, he will stay the course, even without a clear-cut victory. Nor should we expect a revival of the agreement brokered by the UN in July 2022 that restored safe maritime traffic to and from Ukrainian ports. Just as the standoff in the Strait of Hormuz has sent neighboring countries scrambling for new ways to move oil out of the Persian Gulf, Ukraine may be able to move grain through the Danube via Romanian ports and by rail, as it did in the war's early days. But as before, diversions are costly and logistically complicated. For all these reasons, the shape of Russia's war on Ukraine will continue to shift as each side searches for new ways to break the battlefield stalemate in its favor. And the economic damage felt well beyond Ukraine and Russia will continue. Turning the page to the View inbox, one column here, Health Matters, by Veronique Greenwood, staff writer. The preliminary report from the Medical Examiner in the death of Lindsey Graham, a U.S. senator from South Carolina who served for 23 years and died suddenly July 11 at age 71, found he had suffered an aortic dissection. The most common type of that cardiac condition is lethal in about half of patients, and death can be almost instantaneous. For most people who are still alive when their dissection is spotted, often by a CT scan, the primary treatment is emergency open-heart surgery. The typical symptoms are sudden onset of chest pain that can radiate to the back or the neck, says Dr. Graham Cooper, a consultant cardiac surgeon in the UK and a trustee of the Aortic Dissection Charitable Trust. That pain can come and go, or it can be there very strongly, then fade within minutes or hours, depending on how the dissection progresses. Aortic dissections occur when the inner layer of tissue in the aorta, which carries blood from the heart to the rest of the body, ruptures. This allows blood to rush into the space between the lining of the blood vessel and outer parts of the wall, peeling the lining back and weakening the whole structure. Wear and tear on the arteries is often a major cause, says Cooper. Prevention involves keeping blood pressure down and quitting smoking, but it is also important that families in which someone has experienced a dissection talk about it with a medical practitioner, as some cases are linked to genetic mutations that may be passed down. The Brief by Richard Hall, senior editor. The U.S. has been bombing Iran in pursuit of a long-standing American goal to prevent Tehran from acquiring nuclear weapons. Yet elsewhere in the Middle East, it is adopting a very different policy. July 22, the U.S. Department of Energy announced it signed a civil nuclear cooperation agreement deal that would allow Saudi Arabia to have a civilian nuclear program on its own soil in cooperation with American companies. The apparent contradiction between the U.S. approach to Riyadh and its actions in Iran was lost on neither Middle East experts nor nuclear non-proliferation experts, most of whom warned the Saudi pact could kickstart a nuclear arms race in the region. If true, this is tantamount to the United States giving up on non-proliferation. James Acton, co-director of the Nuclear Policy Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, wrote on social media. The highest standards of non-proliferation involve not transferring enrichment technology to a state that openly declares an interest in nuclear weapons, he added. In an apparent reference to the warning by Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman that if Iran developed a nuclear weapon, Riyadh would be forced to do the same. Rosemary Kalanich, director of the Middle East Program at Defense Priorities, tells Time the proposed deal differs from previous nuclear agreements with U.S. allies because the U.S. has always built the plans itself. Whatever safeguards are in place to prevent technology transfer to Riyadh, Iran may still perceive the deal as a definitive move toward a nuclear-armed Saudi Arabia, she said. If Trump's goal in the war is to prevent weaponization, he is actively undermining his own goal because he has done something that is going to encourage Iran to pursue the bomb, just to keep up with the neighbors on the other side of the Gulf, Kalanich said. It soon became unclear whether the deal will go ahead. The morning after it was announced, Trump took to Truth Social to say that it was contingent on Saudi Arabia's joining the Abraham Accords, which would require normalization with Israel. Caroline Leavitt, the White House press secretary, said, if the kingdom does not join, the deal is off. This article is called The Brief Time With. Representative Jason Crow, that's C-R-O-W, pushes service and flipping the House by Philip Elliott. The death threats arrived almost immediately. Representative Jason Crow, along with five other Democrats in Congress with national security backgrounds, had recorded a video last November reminding those working in military and intelligence roles they did not have to follow illegal orders. A message careful to stick to the letter of the law prompted President Donald Trump to call for its makers to be arrested and charged with treason. Hang them, George Washington would, read a social media post Trump publicly shared. A federal grand jury in Washington declined the Justice Department's effort to indict the lawmakers. That victory has not mitigated Crow's anger at how he believes the president's response put his family's safety at risk. I'm really bad at sitting in a foxhole and having people lob grenades at me, Crow, a former paratrooper and Army Ranger, tells Time on a June afternoon at Democratic National Committee headquarters. I'm going to lob them back. The fallout from the viral video placed Crow, 47, in the strongest national spotlight since 2019, when he was a House freshman, tapped to be a prosecutor in Trump's first impeachment trial. In the interim, his stature on Capitol Hill has steadily grown as Crow emerged as a go-to voice for his party on national security. The midterm elections could further elevate his standing as he has helped lead candidate recruitment for House Democrats, prioritizing veterans and others with backgrounds in national security. In Crow's mind, these elections will show voters Democrats have learned how to run effectively on national security issues while still hammering Republicans on the twin tent poles of cost and corruption. At the same time, Crow says his party is in need of a hard reset before 2028, though like many, he's still workshopping ideas for what might work. There is actually an opportunity to build something new, not rebuild, not go back, not try to reconstitute what once was, because Americans don't want that, he says. Should Democrats take the House this fall, Crow is in prime position to be a senior member of the House Intelligence Committee's majority. Should a Democrat reclaim the White House in 2028, his name is likely to come up on short lists for cabinet positions. He also has his eye on Colorado's Senate seat and is not shy about a possible White House run down the line. First, though, Crow has to navigate this tricky political moment, one that has Democrats feeling ascendant but still staring down low approval ratings. It is not entirely unfamiliar terrain for Crow, who rode an earlier anti-Trump wave while vowing to stand up to party leaders he viewed as failing to meet the moment. Only this time he's on the inside. 8 years ago, Crow was one of House Democrats' top recruits, a lawyer and veterans advocate who served three tours in Iraq and Afghanistan. Even still, he was far from a sure thing when he challenged Representative Mike Kaufman, a fixture in Colorado Republican circles since Crow was in middle school. This was an unwinnable race, remember? Crow recalls with a smirk. To show he was not running against just Trump, but Washington writ large, Crow vowed not to vote for Nancy Pelosi for Speaker if Democrats won a House majority, which they did. When it came time for the vote, Crow defied the most powerful Democrat in Washington by casting his ballot for Tammy Duckworth, a fellow veteran representing Illinois in the Senate. I explain this was not personal. This was part of a larger effort to usher in that next generation, Crow recalls. 10 months later, when it became clear the Trump impeachment train was leaving the station for its first go-round, Pelosi rang up her former detractor. It was, Crow said later, like being called into the principal's office. Pelosi needed someone with his skill set and temperament to convey the stakes of Trump's attempts to pressure Ukraine without coming off as a partisan hack. While the House voted to impeach, the Senate declined to convict. For Crow, during that period, death threats became routine. He had an armed guard outside his house. A security detail walked his kids to school, which brings him to last year. The security had to be called back. His illegal orders video brought about another round of threats, including some from Trump, that Crow's office referred to the Capitol Police, according to an email obtained by Time. Crow's national security background has helped propel his reach in Congress, where he is a top Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee, as well as top Democrat on the Armed Services Committee's spy panel. When House Democrats needed someone to run point on a panel investigating the failed assassination against Trump in Butler, PA, they tapped Crow. But it's his work helping Democrats win back the House that may win him the most chits. As a leader in candidate recruitment for the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, Crow has his hands in just about every contested race in the country and is making a point of finding people he believes voters will view as street fighters. "The oath of service I took does not expire," says Joanna Mendoza, a retired Marine Corps drill sergeant and Crow recruit who's taking on Representative Juan Ciscomani, an Arizona Republican, in one of the top toss-up races in the country. Mendoza has the support of Crow and the DCCC well before her primary. It is a different story in some House races in other states, where the DCCC either professed neutrality or backed a different candidate from whomever Crow endorsed through his political action committee, Service First. Crow's theory is some of his preferred candidates, Marine drill sergeants, federal prosecutors, are more likely to excite those who are down on both parties. If his instincts prove right, Crow may bring a whole raft of newcomers to Congress who are loyal to a mentor who helped get them there. Whatever Crow's future ambitions, a cohort of fellow street fighters might come in handy. I have an independent streak to me, he concedes, but you know, when we win, people will be pretty happy about that. Here's a photo. It's half a page and it's in color. Front and center is Jason Crow, a young-looking man, probably tall, but it's hard to tell since he's surrounded by other people whose heights I don't know. He's Caucasian. He has brown hair. It looks like it's neatly trimmed. Brown facial hair. I think brown eyes. He's looking upwards from the camera lens. He's standing in front of a bunch of microphones, and he is surrounded by six other people. He's wearing a blue suit, white shirt, and blue tie. Two of the other men standing near him are also wearing dark suits, light-colored shirts and ties, and three women stand nearby. It's difficult to say whether they're his colleagues or reporters. The brief health. This is five summer skin care tips dermatologists swear by Angela Haupt. Ask a dermatologist what they do once the temperature climbs, and you will quickly realize they do not approach summer the way most of us do. While everyone else is thinking about beach days and begrudgingly applying too much sunscreen, they're thinking about scalp burns, trapped sweat, missed moles, and the tiny mistakes that can add up over years. Some apply antiperspirant before bed, so it has hours to start blocking sweat before the next day's heat. Others keep extra sunglasses stashed in the car or jacket so they're never caught squinting in bright sun. Still others swap heavy moisturizers for lighter formulas as humidity rises. And once they head outside, they're already thinking about the body parts most people fail to protect. Many will not schedule laser treatments for sunspots, flat brown patches on the skin caused by UV damage, until fall, knowing that a few weeks of summer sunshine can undo the results. Some even use dandruff shampoo as a body wash on stubborn skin rashes that are triggered by oil and sweat. None of these habits is the product of eccentricity. They're simply the kinds of adjustments that come from spending every day diagnosing skin cancer, treating sun damage, helping patients undo problems that often could have been prevented. Years of seeing those mistakes have made many of these routines almost automatic. We are so regimented, and we are so particular, it is so funny, says Dr. Purvisha Patel, a dermatologist and founder of Advanced Dermatology and Skin Cancer Associates in Memphis. The people who examine skin for a living, it turns out, tend to be meticulous about their own. Here are five of the summer habits they rarely skip themselves. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And editorializing, as I should not, I'll tell you whether I do the same thing. Number 1. They hit the spots everyone else forgets. Sunscreen failures tend to happen in the same overlooked places. Dermatologists are vigilant about all of them, the tops and backs of ears, the scalp and part line, tops of the feet, backs of the legs, even under the chin, which catches sun on the water. It is not just the sun from above, you're getting the reflection of the water, says Dr. Melanie Palm of Art of Skin MD in San Diego. Don't forget your lips. Palm recommends a balm with zinc. And mind your toes, too. You don't want to have little sausage beans of red digits at the end of the day, she says. My editorial comment, I do not go out in the sun unless I'm dressed like Nanook of the North. Number two, they treat sunglasses as skin care. Sunscreen stops at the eyes, but the sun does not. Cumulative UV exposure is linked to cataracts and growths on the sclera, or white of the eye, which Palm says she sometimes sees in long-term surfers. It can also lead to melanoma of the eye, which is why she looks for sunglass lenses with broad coverage against both UVA and UVB, as well as polarization, if you're around water. Editorial comment two, yes, I do wear transitions lenses. Number three, they let everything breathe. Patel steers clear of tight synthetic fabrics, especially for underwear, which can set you up for rashes, ingrown hairs, and yeast infections. Everything needs to breathe, she says. Her rule of thumb is to choose cotton, which is breathable and wicks moisture away from the skin, unlike synthetics like polyester that tend to trap heat and sweat against it, creating warm, damp conditions that encourage the growth of yeast and bacteria. Editorial comment number three, yep, I wear cotton. Number four, they rinse off the second they stop sweating. Letting sweat dry on your skin is not harmless. As it evaporates, it leaves behind salt that can irritate sensitive or eczema-prone skin, and the lingering moisture can encourage the growth of bacteria on the skin. As the salt sits there, it starts creating an environment that's more acidic, and you can be more prone to things like folliculitis and breakouts, Palm says, which is why a quick rinse after a workout or hot afternoon is a good idea. Number five, if something looks off, they speak up. Because people tend to show more skin this time of year, your partner or friend might notice a suspicious spot, or you might notice one on them. If you do, say something. And if something doesn't match the rest of your spots and moles, it might be worth mentioning to your doctor, Palm says. Yep. Editorial comment number four. Check in with a dermatologist. Reviews. Television. Ted Lasso Sidelines Ted Lasso by Judy Berman. Let's see, here's a little footnote that says new episodes of Ted Lasso are released Wednesdays on Apple TV. Ted Lasso is back, like a band that does a big farewell tour, then reunites before you get the chance to miss it. The mega hit Apple TV, sort of comedy, in which a folksy American football coach leads an underdog English soccer club, has returned. just 3 years after an implicit finale that sent its hero home to his son in Kansas. Season 4 takes co-creator Jason Sudeikis' Ted, who became a nurturing father figure to the surrogate family that was AFC Richmond, back across the Atlantic to shepherd the club's new women's team. It doesn't quite work. The season opens with the jarring image of a bored Coach Lasso manning a supermarket register. Still in the Midwest, a few years after the events of season 3, he loves being with his son, Henry, Grant Feely. But it's a relief when his old boss, Rebecca, Hannah Waddingham, and colleagues Keeley, Juno Temple, and Higgins, Jeremy Swift, fly in to woo him for the Lady Greyhounds. Never mind, he still knows little about soccer, or that there are qualified female candidates. When his ex, Michelle, Andrea Anders, frictionlessly agrees to move with him and Henry to London, everything's coming up Ted. The original cast remains largely intact. Brett Goldstein's seething has-been, Roy Kent, has replaced Ted as the men's coach. Beard, co-creator Brendan Hunt, stuck around to assist Roy, but has gone feral without his professional soulmate. Rebecca and Keeley are battling sexism to get the Lady Greyhounds the financial support they need, which leaves Ted to win over the icy assistant coach Alice, played by the wonderful Tanya Reynolds from Sex Education, who was passed over for his job, and established the same magical bond with his new team that he had with the old one. Oddly, in the 4 episodes sent for review out of 10 total, he barely interacts with them. The original Ted Lasso was a show about masculinity. Neither particularly funny nor especially exciting in its depiction of Premier League play, it offered a comforting vision of macho men improving themselves through bonding and introspection. Ted was the catalyst, the gallant to a gaggle of goofuses. To its credit, the show put Coach Lasso on the analyst's couch, too. His choice to go home concluded an arc that had him end the cycle of dad trauma, in which several characters' struggles were rooted. Ted is a more awkward fit as a father figure to the Lady Greyhounds because, the new gender dynamic could read as less paternal than paternalistic. Make him a voice of reason and he's mansplaining. Have him defer too much and he's the cringy, try-hard male feminist he sometimes resembled in previous seasons. The show's solution is to keep him largely on the sidelines, leaving female characters like Alice and AFC Richmond therapist Sharon, Sarah Niles, to dispense wisdom on such female-coded issues as intra-team cliques. This puts the players at arm's length. There's a mom, a couple, a goalie who refuses to wear gloves, but no Roy or Jamie. Female characters were never the mostly male Ted Lasso creative team's strength. Despite Waddingham's and Temple's charm, Rebecca and Keeley's business plot falters because they continue to interact like giggly teens. Although there are plenty of women writing and directing in season 4, Alice is the only substantial character who does not feel filtered through the male gaze. No longer a tutorial in how to be a good man, Ted Lasso returns as, in parts, a gentle rejoinder to sexism in sports and a gift to those still shipping Roy and Keeley. but mostly a workplace comfort show about nothing in particular. TV could use more scripted stories about female athletes, but a different coach is going to have to preside because Ted Lasso just doesn't belong. Seven questions, and yes, there are seven, I just checked. Mary Steenburgen, Steenburgen, if I'm mispronouncing that, I apologize. I've heard it said both as Steenburgen and Steenburgen. The actor and philanthropist on the appeal of pickleball, the limits of maple syrup, and a humanitarian cause dear to her heart. This is question and answer format, and Sean Gregory writes it. The Dink features pickleball grunters. Does that really happen? Answer. I've heard it in pickleball, and it amuses me even more in pickleball than tennis, because in tennis, legitimately, it's a long way from one side to the other. But with pickleball, it's not that far. You don't have to grunt. Question, you are starring in The Dink, a pickleball comedy released July 24 on Apple TV. Why do you play pickleball yourself? Answer, I saw in it something I could do at this age, 73, that I could get good at, maybe not great or world class, but good at, and go have fun with friends and feel like I had a sport, which I hadn't had since my 40s when I did start swimming competitively. I've missed having that feeling. Question, why do you think pickleball, considered the fastest growing sport in the U.S., is exploding in popularity? Answer, because it's sort of egalitarian. All ages can play. Any body type can play at a level that will bring you pleasure and joy. Question, The Dink plays on a real conflict, the fight over playing space. Pickleball's expansion has ruffled feathers. I have felt this firsthand as I play tennis recreationally and basketball recreationally with my son, and pickleball's encroached on our space. Do you have sympathy for us folks on the other side of this conflict? Answer, not really, laughs. Do I want the sport of tennis, or God forbid, the sport of basketball to ever go away? No. Tennis is elegant, and basketball is, oh my God, a magical sport full of heart and brilliance. And there's room for all of it. Do we all have to keep fighting over things? In the case of basketball, it's you and your son out there. I played pickleball with both my granddaughters last week and learned something about both of them. There is a holy thing to that. I don't think we have to choose between things that are fun. Question, you appeared in Elf, a stone-cold Christmas classic, and actually ate the spaghetti and maple syrup concoction favored by Will Ferrell's character. What did that taste like? Answer, exactly what you think. It is not the worst thing I've ever eaten. Maple syrup makes everything better, but it is not what your taste buds want out of spaghetti. Question, of the 2025 Emmys, you and your husband, Ted Danson, received the Bob Hope Humanitarian Award. You have been active in a variety of causes. Is there anything new you are working on? Answer, there is. I once knew two doctors, and they had a little boy named Sam who had progeria, which is premature aging syndrome. I became friends with this little boy and remained friends with him throughout his all-too-short life. But his mother, along with former NIH director Dr. Francis Collins, found a method of gene editing and a little device that carries that into the organs of the body, that can go in mice and re-edit genes to where someone with progeria today can actually get better. If it works with progeria, there's a chance all these rare and deeply underfunded diseases could actually be alleviated. They need to raise about $20 to $25 million to get this first patient to have this. Question, you are an Oscar winner who has had such a long and varied career. Any bucket list items career-wise? Answer, I have never done Shakespeare. I have never done some of the great Southern kind of plays I probably should have done. I balance what I do between my family and work and my marriage, but I also have a very important career to me that is quite separate, which is why I write music. I do not look at anything about my career with any disappointment. It's crazy to me, still, that I get to do this. One of the things I love about it is I don't have a plan. I feel like what's meant to be mine is going to come my way. And that's Sean Gregory writing about Mary Steenburgen. The article I'm about to start reading will be extremely abridged. Time Off Movies Interview. Christopher Nolan Explains the Odyssey by Eliana Docterman. This spring, when I spoke with Christopher Nolan about his highly anticipated adaptation of The Odyssey, he was reluctant to discuss the ending. He is known as the master of the last act twist, and likes leaving the audience with more questions than answers. He told me he never wants to impose his interpretation on others. Are Cobb's kids in Inception real or imagined? You decide. But now the movie's out and has produced Nolan's biggest worldwide opening ever. When we hopped on the phone shortly before the film's release, it was for a spoiler-filled chat about the film's final act. Readers beware. He offered some insight as to why he made certain changes when adapting the epic poem. We discussed the surprising parallels between The Odyssey and Oppenheimer, why Nolan decided to give Odysseus and Penelope the happy ending they do not get in Homer's epic poem, and how to interpret Zendaya's mysterious character. Is she actually a goddess, or merely a manifestation of Odysseus's guilt? We also dug into Zeus's law and the deeper meaning behind Helen's scarred face. Odysseus is a man who suffers from PTSD, and in your interpretation, who believes he is responsible for the end of a civilization because he violated the ethical code by which the ancient Greeks lived their lives. That is the question by Docterman. Answer by Nolan. My form of storytelling is you take a hero, as we did with Oppenheimer, and Oppenheimer has all these flaws, all these complexities. You find an actor who can take the audience on a journey with that character and make mistakes with that character and not judge that character. And then you step back from that character and go, well, how did we get there? For this movie, you do that through Odysseus's men. That's one of the things in the poem that's breezed over, the way in which the crew ends up getting killed one by one, despite his leadership. In the process of adaptation, you go, that's actually pretty interesting. Maybe we need to make that more center stage. What's the relationship between him and his crew? How do they feel about how he's leading them and the things that befall them? He's a guy who makes a lot of mistakes. His ultimate mistake is the horse. So there's a sort of tragic flaw right from the beginning in our telling. Docterman writes, my interpretation of Zendaya's character is she is not Athena, as Odysseus initially present her. Gods do not exist in this world, but a manifestation of his guilt. During the sack of Troy, we see her as a priestess in the temple of Athena, and the Greeks behead her. For Odysseus, she encapsulates the chaos the horse has wrought on the world. But my editor did not interpret it that way. I'm hoping you will settle our disagreement. Nolan writes, I could not possibly answer that because I learned very early on with Memento that it's unfair to define the experience for the audience by answering questions like that. Here's what I'll say. For me, what was important was that we view the gods the way people at that time might have viewed them. So they're seeing evidence of the gods in nature. They're seeking and finding gods and the influence of gods in the people around them. Odysseus says to Telemachus, "Don't look for gods in men, you'll just be disappointed." And some of what Odysseus says about divinity, to me, is somebody who is protesting a bit too much, someone trying to live in denial of their own instincts and their own practices. Again, Christopher Nolan explains the Odyssey, written by Eliana Doctorman, was abridged. Because we have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine, which is generously supported by G. Suggs Insurance, a SureVest insurance group company. They can be reached at gsuggsinsurance.com. We hope you enjoyed listening. Please join us next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, please call us at the office and studios at 919-832-5138. The number again, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.